Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 46. I'm your host, SAA's Michael Shoebridge, and I'm here with a post-Alaskan head of research, Dr. Marcus Hellyer. Marcus, great to see you weren't eaten by a bear.
No, but we came close. We came close. So there was one very close incident with a polar bear. Fortunately, we all survived, including the polar bear. There was shotguns fired, but not directly at the polar bear.
So SAA sent our head of research off on a heavily armed Alaskan research expedition, and he's back. And it's given him a different sense of perspective. And I hope you'll bring that to today's episode, Marcus.
Well, I was planning on it, and yet I've come back, and it's sort of the more things change, the more they stay the same in some ways. I've been away for a month, and yet it's all very familiar. ANAO reports pointing out defense's inability to deliver on its programs.
Oh, wait, there's a debate about are we spending enough on defense?
That was happening.
Thing about whether the Prime Minister will ever meet President Trump. There's a thing about the government saying that underinvesting in our security is a striking example of our independence and sovereignty.
Yeah, maybe I didn't go to Alaska. Maybe I dreamt it all.
Yeah, you just had a minor concussion.
So I noticed our last podcast went up about 33 days ago, and in it we spoke about this AUKUS review.
The super fast AUKUS review.
Yes, that Elbridge Colby was meant to be doing, and it was meant to come out in 30 days. And has it come out? No, and not yet. Though apparently somebody in the administration is talking to the media. I have a feeling it could be Elbridge Colby because they're saying it was never meant to be 30 days. Where did this 30 days thing come from?
It's not Elbridge Colby. It's a guy called Colby Elbridge. Very different guy.
Well, Colby Elbridge is also saying Elbridge Colby didn't just come up with this. This isn't his brilliant idea. I mean, this is coming from the very top.
Colby Elbridge has always hated Elbridge Colby.
Okay, so bottom line is no AUKUS review just yet. Oh, and also Colbridge Elby has been saying it's not about killing AUKUS. No, it's just about making sure that the US can properly deliver on its commitments and doesn't promise anything it can't deliver.
And the other two partners can properly deliver on their commitments too, which might be where the trouble starts.
Which also gets us to our review. You know, so the UK did a review of AUKUS, which, surprise, surprise, seems to have said, gosh, those colonial suckers have fallen for it. We're going to make massive amounts of money. So this is a great thing for us. So let's keep going.
One thing I think they were very interested in is how can they divert more of the suitcases of cash from heading to Washington and head more of that to London, because that is a financial centre. Mm-hmm.
So, but we're also doing our own AUKUS review, which under Dennis Richardson, a retired
Mandarin.
Who seems unable to ride off into the distance. The government seems to, every time it has a problem and it needs an anodyne answer that basically says, well, you're doing the right thing with a couple of tweaks, but you're basically on the right course.
Well, you should sack that hopeless dozer. He didn't like to do that.
They wheel in Dennis Richardson.
Yep.
And so apparently you were saying that you've heard that he's done the review, but he's only going to report on it verbally to Minister Miles. There won't be an actual written report because, gosh, the Senate might actually be able to request that.
Well, if he writes a report, someone might be able to read the report. But if it's a verbal report, then he's done his report. And unfortunately, it can't be revealed, even though everybody wants to, because it doesn't exist.
Well, you don't want people reading the report because the wrong people might read it.
Well, the wrong people might come to the right conclusions, or the right people might come to the wrong conclusions. But either way, it's a bad thing. So the best thing is to pay someone a whole lot of money to do a review, but not get a review.
So anyway, I've been away, and all of these AUKUS reports don't seem to have been made public yet. So we can't discuss them
Well,
today.
I actually got in touch with Bridge, and everyone says they know Bridge Colby well.
Well, you're talking about Colbridge.
If you know
Elbridge
really well, if you're great mates, you call him Bridge.
So the original one.
I said, Bridge, Shoebridge here. And he said, Shuba.
He doesn't call you Bridge?
He calls me Shuba.
Not Shuey, Shubo.
Yeah.
And you call him Elbow?
I don't like it, but, you know, I let him do it. I said, Marcus is away in Alaska shooting polar bears.
Marcus Bridge.
Yeah, he's away. Would you mind delaying your review? And he said, no problem. So that's what's happening.
Oh, okay.
I was going to wait for you to come back. So I wanted to cover some things, sort of narrower things about defence, even a bit of good news.
Good news.
So something about the Arafura, something about HIMARS firing some, another order of some weapons, and then talk about what the parlous state of the Navy fleet is because of the audit review.
Okay. I thought you said good news.
Well, that's no, sorry, the good news ended before I got to the audit report on the state of the Navy. Okay. And then I would like, and I think you would too, to spend the second half of the podcast talking about the government's recent statements of foreign and defence policy, all linked really to the Prime Minister's current visit to Beijing, Shanghai, and of course Chengdu, but not Tokyo or Seoul while he's in North Asia. So let's start with the Arafura, because I think that's the most good news.
Well, I guess the good news is that the previous government's continuous naval shipbuilding policy, which was sort of launched way back, sort of 2016, 2017, there was a naval shipbuilding plan that was going to deliver
continuous shipbuilding.
Continuous shipbuilding and submarines and major service combatants and patrol vessels.
Yep.
Guess what? We're about somewhere between $10 and $12 billion in the hole in that overall program at this point.
8-9 years in. Yep.
We now have the first ship delivered.
Of continuous shipbuilding. So 9 years and $12 billion, and we've got one patrol vessel.
Very heavily armed with one large machine gun.
Has it got the gun that the Armidales had, the second-hand gun? So it's got
It's actually the same
gun. It's actually the guns from the Armidales, I think. They're refurbishing them and putting them on Arafura. So it's at least as heavily armed as the much smaller, cheaper Armidale class.
I think at least technically is a correct description, yes.
But I suppose it can't actually be as effective with that gun because it's a much bigger ship, so it's kind of fat. You can't traverse the gun quite as far because it's the larger superstructure of the ship obstructs you.
I don't know. We're getting a little technical there.
It's like a fat lady with a shotgun.
Beyond my... That's very rude, Michael. So look, as I've said before, I sort of feel a sense of ownership, you know, a bit of paternal pride in the Arafura OPV, because the original germ of that concept was the 2009 white paper, and I worked on the force structure review, and we had this brilliant idea that we would replace three classes of ships, so the patrol boats, the hydrographic ships, and the mine warfare vessels, with one class bigger, but it was this multi-role vessel that could do all of it. And over the last, what are we now, 16 years, that vision has sort of chopped and changed a bit, but we've at least got something. Now, along the way...
I want to congratulate you. You have replaced three classes of ship with one single vessel.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
Fortunately, doesn't do any of the roles particularly well, and in fact, comprehensively doesn't do two.
Comprehensively doesn't do hydrography or mine warfare, but unfortunately nothing else in the ADF will be doing mine warfare, because one of the outcomes of the National Defence Strategy last year was essentially to let our mine warfare capability completely atrophy. So even though our whole sort of force structure is about defending sea lanes of communication, we don't have a plan to do mine clearance.
No one is going to be rude enough to use mines against our Navy because they'll know we don't have mine warfare capability. It's not chivalrous.
Be unchivalrous. Yeah. It's like using pikemen to defeat knights.
That's right.
Yes, well, so we've finally got an Arafura. There is that sort of awkward issue of what are we going to use them for now that the original kind of raison d'etre has kind of changed. But
well, I remember, didn't the Defence Strategic Reviewers say the Arafura role didn't make any sense? And if the Navy was going to get them, it better work out something useful to do with it.
Yes, well, it seems to be that coming out of the Surface Fleet Review, the direction was, well, they'd be really good in a kind of Pacific roles, working with our smaller partners in the South Pacific, and it can focus on that. So let's see. We have a ship.
So there's two other things I'd like to mention because of the Arafura. So, well, there was the weird abortion of a build strategy of build the first two over in Adelaide and transfer the build. But one thing that's happened is Lursen, the German ship designer and builder that was partnered with CIVMEC, has exited stage left.
Yes, I think rather unhappy circumstances. Yeah, they were massively burned by their Australian experience. They came into the offshore patrol vessel program thinking that this would be the gateway into the Asia-Pacific market.
The rivers of gold of the Indo-Pacific market.
And they've sort of gone back to Germany with their tail between the legs saying, gosh, working with the Australians didn't go so well, did it?
So that happened, but CIVMEC bought Lursen out, so presumably they own the rights to the design so they can make more of these ships that the Navy doesn't really have a purpose for.
Well, there's four. So you will recall that the build program was cut from 12 to 6 in the Service Fleet Review. So the first two built in Adelaide, the next four in Henderson. So CIVMEC is progressing with those four. Now, CIVMEC, I think, can now say, well, we're a shipbuilder. We've built these four ships.
That's where I was getting to.
So we this issue of, you know, we've got the Henderson complex, not a psychological complex, but I think it will become a psychological complex. The Henderson complex of, well, the government has said Austal is our strategic shipbuilding partner, but the company that's actually currently building steel warships in Henderson is CIVMEC.
Well, anyway, we've heard a lot of hoopla about the strategic shipbuilding partner, but I haven't seen anything announcing that the government has actually signed anything with Austal to give that effect. So there's confusion now because of CIVMEC staying in the business. And so there's the sort of exiting of Lursen and CIVMEC being left as the designer builder now. There's also, in the continuous naval shipbuilding plan back in 2016, 2017, the Henderson precinct was designated as one of the two surface ship construction precincts in the country. One was Adelaide for larger, more complex surface ships. Mm-hmm. The other one was Henderson. And there was meant to be a plan, a Henderson master plan, to create this new precinct.
We're working on it, Michael. I mean, last year the government commissioned a plan for $200 million or something to work out what the plan for Henderson was. The only trouble is it's not meant to be delivered for another 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, so 8 years after the Henderson precinct was first designated a precinct with a master plan for the precinct, Defence has convinced the current government to put, how much is it? Is it $300 or $200 million into a piece of design and concept work about creating a Henderson precinct? My point about this is Henderson does not exist as a precinct. It's a ragtag bunch of separate sites under various different ownerships, some state government, some corporate, probably even some local government land. And we're still years out from having even a plan to make it a shipbuilding and submarine maintenance precinct, which it needs to be quite soon.
Yes.
Because if the general purpose frigate build is transferred from Germany or Japan to Henderson.
Yes, well, if you start sort of counting back the years from when the first Australian-made general-purpose frigate is meant to be delivered, which probably be around about 32, 33, you start to go, well, we kind of need to start building that pretty soon, but it's not quite clear who's going to build it, what the commercial arrangements are, physically where it's going to happen. I mean, the best shed in Henderson is actually CIVMEC's shed, but Austal are the, quote, strategic shipbuilding partner. The government hasn't actually said who's going to do the building.
And there's meant to be a whole lot of major construction around new docks for surface ships and submarines.
And there's submarines, so...
So I just think there's a concurrency problem because the whole point of building the precinct was it was meant to happen years ago and they haven't even got the study done for the concept of what it might be.
Yep. So anyway. So
something else beginning with H.
But we have got the first ship.
Let's celebrate that. The first HIMARS firing has happened by the Australian Army at Talisman Sabre in 2025. Mm-hmm. Lots of things going whoosh.
Yes. Yes. Hopefully the ones that went whoosh at Talisman Sabre aren't the only rockets we actually have. I think this is a bit along the lines of SM-6 and Tomahawk. Firing. So the Navy missiles is that we've fired them. We just don't actually have any stocks of our own. So...
Well,
anyway,
you know, I'm hoping this is a bit like the drug dealer approach. Your first hit is free. After that, you've got to pay. So I'm hoping that even
these
test firings of the HIMARS were maybe gifted to us by the Americans, but we'll pay from now on.
Well, I don't think the Americans are gifting us any missiles. Earth calling, okay. Michael. So, well, because the government has announced we're spending $2 billion on AMRAAMs, so anti-aircraft missiles to be fired off our fighter planes and to be fired off the NASAMS ground-based air defence system. And good missile.
$2 billion.
NASAMS is a very good system. Our fighters are, you know, world class. So that's all good. The only problem is if you are using AMRAAM as your primary air defence interceptor, you're back in that land of a couple of $1 million a shot in a world where people are throwing stuff at you at a few hundred or tens of thousands of dollars a shot.
This is why the Ukrainians have just turned a pilot program to use first-person view drones as interceptors around Kiev into a complete funded program, because even if it doesn't shoot down even the majority of drones and missiles, any that are shot down with these cheaper alternatives save you money and very scarce, expensive missiles.
Yes. And look, and we know that ASCA, the Advanced Strategic Capabilities Accelerator.
I think it's advanced in the decrepit sense. You know, when you reach an advanced age.
God, you're so rude, Michael. It hasn't been around that long. But yeah, so we know they issued an RFT, an approach to market for these cheap interceptors.
Yes.
So there's something going on there. But, you know, all right, now I'll be a bit rude. So when I look at these ASCA ATMs, I look at them and I go, we are in the world of taking the standard CASG documentation suite and sort of trying to whittle it down a bit, rather than starting from first principles and going, what is the absolute minimum amount of documentation we need here? But anyway, as we know, it's change of leadership at ASCA happened before I went away. Maybe
Brigadier Meggett, a warfighter
in charge. So hopefully that will bring a change both in mindset and speed.
I wish ASCA did have an ATM, because one of their flaws is they've got no actual procurement budget. So they may be able to do these announcements.
See, this is one of the things that hasn't changed. Your bad dad jokes have not gone away.
No. Well, you've only been away a day. You were concussed. Yes. So worse news than all of that.
So there is some good news. So, you know, some capabilities are entering service.
Yeah.
I will just rudely note that they tend to enter service on a pace, which means they're sort of irrelevant by the time they arrive because the world has changed, as is the case with the Arafura class OPV. But stuff is arriving.
Capabilities in service turn out not to be in service terribly well. Mm. So while you're away, I was working hard in the bunker. And actually, the air quality was better because there was only me there rather than two people, and the scrubbers are far more efficient.
Well, this is not the first time I've been described as an oxygen thief, Michael.
I wasn't. Well, it might have been. Anyway, I was working hard is the point I was making. And the National Audit Office report into the systemic, comprehensive, long-term failures of defence and the Navy and its contractor workforce to be able to...
No, I saw that one. They put that one out back in 2021 and then again in 2022 and then again in 2020 and then... So, sorry, are you saying this is another thing that hasn't changed? Another bad audit report about...
But this is a high point in bad, I think. This is like... Baden-Baden, that German town.
The German what?
Baden-Baden, the German...
Baden-Baden. Yeah, Baden-Baden.
That's what I said.
Yeah, I got there for my spa. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is...
Very
was,
refreshing and this, invigorating.
This was that town without the spa. So the Navy doesn't even have enough money to pay to have its surface fleet maintained so it can operate safely.
Yeah, but why would you want to do that when you've got AUKUS submarines coming in 20 years?
And not only does it not have the money, so the audit report revealed there's a cash crunch. The Navy asked for $500 million in supplemental urgent funding to sustain its surface fleet, including the big amphibious ships, over two financial years. It got $300 million, leaving it with a $200 million shortfall.
Beggars can't be choosers.
And that tells me...
I mean, if they took... they'd have to take money away from AUKUS, Michael.
They would. And that had already been spent on the business class fares of ASA personnel.
Well, and the contents of that brown paper bag slash suitcase that Richard Miles carried over to Washington.
But beyond the funding, even the commercial management of the contractors was... appallingly inept. So there was the example of BAE, the builder of the ships, years into the build.
Is this the same BAE that essentially has a monopoly on shipbuilding for the Navy for the next 127 years?
Building the Hunters, and it's building the Snorkus.
Yep.
That same company.
Yep.
So there were something like over 6,000 defects on the first ship.
It's a big ship, though. I mean, there must have been thousands of things that actually worked. I mean, you're always dwelling on the negative. 6,000 defects, come on.
Some of those were minor, but after years of working on them, there were still a number of critical defects.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what Defence did? To hold BAE to account, it excused...
Let me guess. They held BAE to account.
Yes, and they did it in a very clever way.
Okay.
Which was they excused them from all liability for remaining problems from the build. So gave up all contractual rights. But yes. BAE promised to make in-kind contributions, which I think was very kind of them.
Oh, so our cunning strategy was to essentially let BAE off the hook in return for sort of some vague commitment about BAE being nice to us in future.
Well, because they're very important partners, Marcus.
Mm.
Yeah.
Strategic partners, even.
Now, I'm not sure that's worked because the ships failed. Each of them failed. One in 2022, one in 2023 on South Pacific disaster relief missions. They had total power failures.
I mean, there you go, being all negative again. I mean, at least they do get to sea sometimes. I mean, the replenishment ships don't go to sea at all. They've been thoroughly broken. I mean, so come on. Gosh, what does it take to make you happy?
But actually, there's another good thing, isn't there, out of the new supply ships not being able to put to sea because they're defective, which is you save a lot on the operating budget and on the maintenance budget.
Do you, though? Because a lot of those costs are kind of locked in and your strategic partners need to get paid whether your ships are sailing or not.
But a serious thing that this ANAO audit report of the Navy's surface fleet sort of surfaced for me was there is a lack of technical competence in the Navy workforce and in the contractor workforce and certainly in the CASG workforce.
Mm-hmm.
There is a failure of commercial acumen and a failure to apply even standing core procurement and probity policies.
But other than that, they're doing a good job.
And the result is the ships are not seaworthy and fail on missions.
But other than that...
If I was an American, I would be looking at this and saying, so I've just had Jonathan Mead from the Submarine Agency visit me, and he's told me about Australia's firm commitment at a whole of nation...
To be nuclear ready.
...whole of enterprise level to be... nuclear ready and to be nuclear stewards. The burden and obligation of nuclear stewardship is one that they're firmly committed to meeting. And I'd say to him, but Jonathan, you can't look after reasonably straightforward large surface ships, many of whose components are shared with the cruise industry.
Yes. Yes, these ships are essentially commercial off the shelf.
They're not complex warships.
And they're quite new.
Yes.
So, yes, if I was the head of naval reactors in the US, I'd say, how about you guys show that you are conventional ready before you all this talk about nuclear ready? Yeah,
I want to see your conventional surface ship stewardship, certainly in your support and enabling vessels, including your big amphibious ships, before I trust you people with anything to do with a nuclear reactor.
But again, it is another example of this point that you've made many times, that all of these massive programs like AUKUS, they're all about delivering stuff way off in the future, and so the defence leadership can stare into the future and say, we are delivering these amazing capabilities, strategic capabilities, and it's all just amazingly huge and bigly.
The complexification...
No one actually holds them accountable for what we have today. You know, so that issue of, you know, fight tonight, you go to war with what you have, we've just chucked that out the window as we stare off into this brave new future.
Sometime in the distance, yes.
Many decades off into the future.
Anyway, Richard Miles is talking about streamlining and simplifying the defence organisation, I think in part because of the incredible systemic failures he's seeing in reports like this. I hope he's read the whole thing. He should. The thing that bothers me, though, and I think you probably share this, is yet another reorganisation and a slight slimming of hierarchies and collapsing things like the Guided Weapons Enterprise and the National Shipbuilding and Sustainment Group back in to a rebadged acquisition outfit called something stirringly manful, like an armaments director. That really is just going back to the previous structure with a new name. And unless you get different people in with the right skills, you will just rinse and repeat all these same problems.
Yes. Well, gosh, there's so many things to be said here. First one is the current secretary has been in the job, by my back of the fag packet calculation, of what, 8 years, maybe? Mm-hmm. 8 years? Mm-hmm. He owns these problems. So,
well, secretaries are responsible for the administration of the public resources, including people and money, in their entities, in their organisations. And this is systemic failure in all of that.
So if he's not delivering value for money, and one thing I will point out is that is common to all of these ANAO reports, is that they basically say defence is unable to assess whether it is delivering value for money because it hasn't really set its processes up properly. And so I tend to criticise the ANAO by saying, well, they always focus on process and we don't really see the outcome. What are we actually getting? The problem is it's very hard to measure success if you haven't set your kind of processes up the right way around. So, and that is a common feature to all of this. So if you're a secretary and your department can't show whether it is delivering value for money and you've been running it for 8 years.
Yes. You can't say it's a working process.
Who's the problem here?
I've been badly let down by all the people.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Losers.
Yeah.
No, well, you sort of go, gosh, there's a lot of mid-level permafrost there.
Yep.
A lot of mid-level permafrost.
There are a lot of bucks that stop in the secretary's bank account, and I think one buck needs to stop there. Yeah. Now, so back on to get out of the bunker, get out of this Russell Hill-centered mm-hmm. thing that you've made me fall into. Let's think about the wider world. Let's think about Penny Wong doing that fantastic job of recognising ASEAN's centrality at the ASEAN meeting she was at recently. Showing a very steely-eyed awareness, I think, of Beijing and of the importance of America's military role in stability. And unkind people have said she was only trotted out to say those things so that Albo could quietly point to statements by a senior minister so that he didn't have to say them himself when he was anywhere.
So he wouldn't have to raise them with Xi Jinping because Penny's done it for him.
It's in the
back. All this stuff about lack of transparency around China's build-up of its military capabilities, some stuff about some bad behavior on the part of China. Penny's done that, so Albo can basically go and eat lobster.
Yep, and drink Australian wine with a smile. Yeah, while signing up a lease for pandas.
Because of all of those jobs, apparently.
Yeah, well, so you read Penny Wong's speech and you had that sort of collision of she's sort of between two different worlds. You know, there's the rules-based order world and that old thing about ASEAN-centered region. And then there's the hard realism of, well, unfortunately, we seem to be in a power-based world and China's out to dominate the region.
Yes, I have to say, I've read her speech. I read Albo's curtain oration and I'm just really having trouble bringing it altogether. So Ms. Wong said, we will keep investing not only in our traditional relationships, but also in a more diverse set of partnerships. Traditional boilerplate, which is essentially saying, we're not just focused on US-China. We're interested in the little guys, in new members of ASEAN. So, we can walk and talk and chew gum at the same time.
Who are new partners that aren't countries we know well and have been engaging with for a couple of decades? Is it Southeast Asia? Because
you haven't heard of this, the new Republic of Kumquatistan that just materialized in Indochina?
There's the Houthis. Are the Houthis there?
I'm sort of struggling to know who these new partners are that haven't actually been on the scene for quite a
What's
long time.
What's the part of Somalia? It's the good bit.
Oh.
There's that little
Puntland, is it?
Puntland. Yeah. It might be Puntland and the Houthis.
So she went to Kuala Lumpur to talk about Punt. No,
I mean, just don't know who these new partners are.
It is dog whistling kind of stuff in the sense of it's code, which is, oh, we're not just obsessed about US and China. Then we go on to talk about how obsessed we're obsessed with US and China. So then there's this kind of, it's almost Malesian kind of statement of, we will keep working to uphold the international rules and norms that underpin our prosperity. This rules and norms. So these are the rules and norms that both the US and China are working to undermine, or at best case, simply ignore.
Ignoring. World Trade Organization, international
So we're upholding. Unfortunately, the two great powers of our region aren't, but anyway. And so our intent is to prioritize our region. Gosh, boy, that's deep. Our relationships.
Well, Marcus, we live in this
region. So we're going to prioritize our relationship. Gosh, okay. We're not going to prioritize the relationships we don't have. And we'll prioritize the rules that protect us, so we can uphold our values and deliver on our interests. So we are going to uphold the rules that protect us. Meanwhile,
who are we delivering our interests to?
So it's sort of these weird motherhood sorts of statements that seem to ignore the fact that the US and China are actively undermining those rules.
It's like a collision of different concepts that have been put in a blender and then spat out in a Word document.
Yeah. But then we also know that the Trump administration envisages a different role for the United States. So there's a sort of bit of dog whistling there about, yeah, okay, we know that the Trump administration is basically bonkers.
I think that's one of those traditional relationships that we're diversifying away from.
Yes, and it's always been true that two countries can be the strongest of allies without agreeing on every single element of policy.
In other words, there's a lot we hate about how Trump's rolling.
But then, I think this is key, the United States' presence in our region remains critical to the Indo-Pacific strategic stability and reinforces the ability of all of its countries to make choices in their own sovereign interests. Oh, so this is the fundamental. Okay. Well, you actually need the US to maintain the peace, that if the US withdraws and China becomes a hegemon, then countries will not be able to make their own choices in their own sovereign interest.
Maybe I like this traditional relationship.
So we actually do like the US being here preserving peace.
Okay, but why did Albo then give his behind the curtain oration where he made a bunch of dog whistling statements about how America was so last season and the greatest thing about curtain during the Second World War was he really told those Brits and Americans what they could do with themselves and brought the troops?
Well, because we're not dependent on the US, Michael, even though actually the region is dependent on the US for peace and stability.
After Curtin gave the Americans what for, he located, General MacArthur located himself in Melbourne and took command of Australian and US forces for the entirety of the campaign in the Pacific.
Mm. Yes. And then actually, after that, we did sort of drift a bit back to the UK after World War II. And then Ms. Wong says, I have always said that China takes the world as it is and we seek to shape it for the better.
So China takes the world as it is.
No, we take the world as it is. And that this is after she's referred to the worrying pace of China's nuclear and conventional military build-up without the transparency that the region expects. So this is the bit where if anybody says, gosh, you guys are soft on China, you know, and Albo's spending 6 days swanning around China, not raising these issues with Xi Jinping, and go, oh, but Penny's covered off.
Penny said it.
Ms. Wong has covered off.
Penny. Now, you know, I'm a critic of the Chinese Communist Party, but I will not stand for them being criticised for not being transparent about their goals and aims. They are crystal clear that they want to seize Taiwan and they want their military built to be able to do that whenever Xi Jinping decides to do it. And they're delivering on that. They're doing a force structure building and they're doing posturing and exercising and practicing. So they are being as transparent as you could ask them to be.
Well, this is what I find so amusing around these claims of inadequate Chinese transparency. What would transparency look like to you? Because Xi Jinping has been very transparent. He's told the PLA to be ready to take China, Taiwan.
At a moment's notice. That's,
you know,
that's
he's told
cool.
them to have a, quote, world-class military.
He hasn't given us a timeline, has he? He's leaving it to others to speculate about a timeline. Maybe that's where he's not being transparent.
I mean, considering this is coming from a government that is no longer allowing the ANAO to publish dates of initial operating capability and final operating capability for Australian defence projects. So
Or even dates about shipping of secondhand tanks to Ukraine because that's so operationally
intensive. It has chucked micro transparency out the window. It's criticising China for lack of transparency, even though they've been very, very transparent about their intent.
They're disturbingly transparent.
But anyway, so Ms. Wong has put the Chinese in their place and has raised these issues about Chinese military
And Albo has gone strong about putting it up those Americans.
And that is why, says Ms. Wong, we are realistic about China's objectives in changing the regional balance of power. So China, this regional balance of power, which we've just said is essential
to maintaining security and prosperity. Yep.
Yes, everybody to make choices in their own sovereign interests. Yep. And it is clear in China's public political discourse. So China actually has made it clear. It is transparent. Okay. They do want to change this balance of power. They've been quite transparent about
this. I think that's true.
So we're realistic about that. Okay. We're realistic about that. Good. Yeah. However, we won't increase our defence spending. But, and this realism, so this word realism also informs how we have stabilised our relationship with China and we have strengthened our partnerships with the rest of the region. So basically, we've acknowledged China wants to change the regional balance of power, mm-hmm. and being realistic about that, we've decided we need to suck up to
we
China
better
on
get
trade.
On good with them. That sounds like the beginnings of bandwagoning with Beijing, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Well, so when we put all of this together and put on our international relations theorist hat, there's these three kind of, when the balance of power starts to shift, new great power emerges, mm-hmm. challenging the old great power, yep. all yep. of the
You've
countries.
Got bandwagoning?
Yes, you can bandwagon, which yep. is you can get on board with the new great yep. power. You know,
I love these new guys.
Laos, Cambodia, classic yep. examples yep. of bandwagoning. Can balance, so you can join with the old great power.
I don't love these new back. Guys. Why don't we all get together and try and slow them down or stop them?
You know, and you can yeah. argue maybe that's what the Quad was in yep. some ways, even yep. though India wouldn't admit to that. Yep. But yep. And then there is hedging, where you sort of hedge your bets. You sit in the middle.
It's not you growing something like to put between you and them.
You know, you sort of, you like don't bet. Commit. You could argue right. Indonesia, classic case of hedging yes. there. Doesn't yes. want to declare its hand.
Friend to all, enemy to none.
You know, it's like,
it's
well,
quite beautiful.
You know, we don't.
Yeah, I got this Russian spaceport. I'm buying those Russian missiles. I like these American things too. Mm-hmm. What about some of that Indian stuff?
So when I look at this, I just, taking Penny Wong's statements, Albo's statements, I don't really know where the government sits in all of this. And it's certainly to me, I mean, Ms. Wong uses the term realism. Well, she's not using realism in a classic international relations sense. I mean, I think she may be using it in the realism is the same as realistic, i.e. yes. clear-eyed, but it is yeah. not realism in the international relations sense.
Which is more just a brutal, I mean, if we power-driven
put on
a, world.
Yes,
yeah,
so we put on our John yeah. Mearsheimer hat. Realism means accepting that the world is anarchic. You know, the great powers are going to do what great powers can get away with. And it's what we're seeing with Putin. It's what I would say we're seeing with Xi Jinping's mm-hmm. China. If that's the case, you don't appeal to rules and norms.
No, because you're in a power-based
you
world.
You need power.
Yeah.
And we don't want to spend the money on building our power.
Well, this is where I think the Prime Minister is so vacuous when in his curt narration and elsewhere he's said how strong and sovereign it is for us to make our own decisions about things like defence spending, when he's not allocating enough money to fund even the force that his government says they plan. So that's not strong and sovereign. That's in a state of chronic denial and making yourself even more dependent than you were before on the power you're saying you're so independent of.
But his foreign minister has just said this. The United States' presence in our region remains critical to stability and allows countries in the region to make choices in their own sovereign interest.
You know what
interest.
It looks like to me? It looks like we are bandwagoning with China because we think they're the coming thing.
Well, certainly on trade.
And we want to get in as deep as possible with the economic dependence. We're doubling down on that. The trade minister, the treasurer and the prime minister have all said they want to grow at the two-way trade. And we know China will use that as horrible economic coercive leverage. They're the biggest sticks to hit people over the head with that are dumb enough to become economically dependent on them.
Well, I was reading this editorial in the Canberra Times, the local rag, the other day, saying, isn't it great that the Albanese government, awesome, they've stabilised their relationship with China. They've done such a great job. Well, actually, it's not very hard to stabilise the relationship with China. If you do what they want you to do and say what they want you to say, it's fine.
Well, that's bandwagoning. So I think we're bandwagoning, but at the same time, we are mainstreaming American military presence and power into our country. So we're kind of bandwagoning with China and free riding on America. And I think that's the worst of both worlds if you want to make independent decisions. So I think we're like Joe Bjelke-Petersen described, and he said, you can't sit on the fence and keep your ear to the ground without horrible things happening.
Sounds very uncomfortable. Ooh. But yeah, like as I've said, if you think the US, your security is dependent on the US, and the US is saying, well, your share of that is now 3.5% of GDP because that's what we're paying. Well, okay, that's one choice you have. The other choice is to say, well, actually, we want to go our own way. Well, and as you've written, you know, numerous times, well, then the cost is a lot more than 2% of GDP. If you want to replace all of those missing US capabilities, it's a lot more than 2% of GDP. And it's probably a lot more than 3.5% of GDP.
Well, you've also, I didn't include this in my estimate where you might have to pay three times, you know, more like 6% of GDP just to replace all the legacy stuff. There's also a land care and remediation cost for filling in all the joint facilities like Pine Gap and Harold E. Holt. So there's this big land remediation cost there too.
Okay, well, you can mobilise the youth of Australia to plant trees there, so it's not bad. But, you know, there's two big choices you can make. But the thing that is common to both is you're looking at least 3.5% of GDP.
Yep.
Or you can not make a choice and you can simply kind of abdicate responsibility in making hard decisions, which seems to be what the government is doing, and that is revert to a kind of barely armed neutrality in the South Pacific and hope that the world just passes you by and China keeps buying your iron ore and lobsters and World War III doesn't break out and we'll just sit down here in our social democratic paradise.
And congratulate ourselves.
And congratulate ourselves.
I think we'll be like Joe Bjelke-Petersen. We will find it very uncomfortable to sit on the fence and keep our head.
So bottom line is, I just find it very hard to find the strategic coherence, the golden thread running through all of these things coming out of the government, other than a kind of wishful thinking that we can somehow have our cake and eat it too.
I actually think it's simpler. I think with China, it just demonstrates that greed beats fear. And with America, it's just, we don't expect you to walk away, so it doesn't matter what we do. And I think both things are problems for our country.
Mm-hmm.
So welcome back from Alaska, Marcus.
Thank you, Michael.